Let's see, we quit talking when, what's the fellow's name? Chalk Van Meeker.
Is that it?
Yeah, he sold the diamond for $5,000. The currency of the land was British pounds, but I'm converting it to the currency of that day, 1880, $5,000 was a pile of money. I'd be better than having $25,000 nowadays. That is earned money by the time you pay taxes on it. There were not many diamonds found in that area, although all of the farmers rushed down to the gravels and were searching through them. In fact, 10 months went by before two tiny stones not of much value were found. So the people tended to drift back to their farming and forget about diamonds. But Schalk Van Meeker kept his eyes open, and about 2 years later, he saw a witch doctor, female, believed in women's lib in those cannibalistic tribes. And her name was Bowie, and she had a leather thing around her waist from which was hanging shrunken heads and stuff that she used in practicing her medicine. And in addition, there was a great big diamond tied to her waist with a leather thong, bigger than your fist. And Schalk Van Meeker could see that it was a diamond. And so he bargained with Bowie to make a trade. And he gave her cattle and sheep and copper wire to wrap around her arms and neck and various European trinkets that caught her fancy, and she made the trade. Well, this diamond, he sold for $55,000. And this diamond weighed 68.5 carats, and it was nearly perfect. Well, Niekerk cheated Bowie, and the guy that bought it from Niekerk cheated him. It was worth millions. Well, of course, this aroused interest again. But still, they did not find much in the way of diamonds in that particular locale. But they had been prepared now for the find which was shortly to come. I may overlap some statements I made before, I don't remember that well. But diamonds are something that in the rough might not be recognized unless you had a little bit of knowledge concerning them. Part of the knowledge that they learned is that a diamond, when you first touch it, is always cold. And the reason for that is because it has such a high thermal conductivity, and it also has a high heat capacity. Now, people will often confuse thermal conductivity with heat capacity. But I don't want to go into that at this point because it'll probably take me the rest of the day to get through this story if I keep it up. But somebody put down in a note, I'm going to be gone for a week and I won't remember this at all, but when I come back to talk about heat capacity and thermal conductivity somewhere along the line. Well, it sucks heat away from your fingers, so to speak, and consequently, when you first touch it, it feels cold. Okay?
Can I ask a quick question about the story? You're not going to be here next week, is that right, or the week after?
Next week. That's the week that you're going to do all this writing that you haven't started yet. I'm going to be down in Los Angeles basking in the lovely Los Angeles weather all week, I hope, unless I decide to go up to San Francisco in the middle of the week. It's probably pretty good up there, too.
I thought you had a convention.
Well, yeah, but when you go to a convention, you know.
Travel around a little, too.
Yeah.
Maybe it's on the beach. It's a bath.
You enjoy it. You take your wife along. Besides, I'm getting old enough, I need to relax. I've worked so hard up to this point in my life, just worn myself out. You rationalize anything you see. Well, they also learned that diamonds often are in this shape, but not always. In fact, most of them aren't in that shape. But in addition to having triangular faces, diamonds tend to have triangular ridges, sometimes by the thousands, just barely apart. Sometimes, well, most of the time you can see some of them with your eye. Now, those things may be steps down, like a second living room, or they may be steps up. You'll see them both ways, and sometimes they'll go up, sometimes they'll go down. So even though your diamond may have been rough from its travail with nature through millions of years, you will usually see someplace on there where there will be rather perfect rectangular or equilateral triangles. So that is characteristic of diamonds. And then, of course, they have their own look, which is called the adamantine luster. It's unique to diamond. Nothing looks like diamond. Adamantine luster. Then they sort of have a greasy feel in addition. They do feel a little bit slippery, and then they are hard, and if you think it's a diamond, pick up some other rocks and scratch, and that's sort of the test. One day a farmer by the name of Dutoit, went to an area of his farm where there was a yellow patch of clay. They were sort of roughly circular, and in cross section, if you could have looked through the land, every once in a while you'd see these depressions. And they were so common in the area that the people called them pans. See a cross section of a pan. And the dirt in here was yellow in color. They called it yellow ground. Dutoit procured some of this yellow ground in a bucket, mixed it with a little water, it was sort of like clay, and was troweling this mixture in between the cracks in his log cabin to keep the wind from blowing through. And the tip of his trowel happened to strike something hard. He heard it strike something hard. And just out of curiosity, he plucked that thing out and wiped it off, and he immediately recognized it was a diamond. And that event is history's first record of a diamond being found in a location other than the river gravels. It was found in this yellow ground in these pans. Well, he went out and dug around some more and he found additional diamonds. And of course the word spread rapidly, and pretty soon all of the farmers were scurrying over this part of the country looking for diamonds. There were approximately 200 pans in that area, and eventually 20. Or 10% of the pans were shown to contain diamond. Now, this is probably a little bit hard on their religion. You know how it is. Your religion, when you're struggling and things are tough, the religion survives. But when you got diamonds or gold around, I'm only speculating. I just assume that that's the usual story. When wealth comes, you don't need religion anymore, people think. Well, the British government soon got into the picture, and they allowed a person to have a square claim that was 31 foot on each side. And people began to dig down into the pans and sort out the diamonds just by hand at first. I have seen a picture of how this progressed. Boy, they really dug, but they didn't dig at the same rate. And this yellow ground is not strong. So one guy might, you know, have his claim standing up like that, the other guy's put it down here. The ground being soft, you know, this is going to come over here and there'll be lots of trouble. And there was a lot of trouble. Lots of murders, fights, arguments, the usual thing that you have in any situation where it looks like you're going to get rich quick. I start to say I have seen a picture when they got down here deeper. They started to bring the stuff up in buckets by wire ropes going up to the rim. And that thing is closer together than a spider web, just ropes rimming that whole thing down into there where they had buckets and were hauling it up. Well, as time went on, claims were consolidated, people bought each other out. And as they became consolidated, more money would be involved. People with money to truly develop it. The farmers didn't have, you know, any, about all they could afford in the beginning, I guess, was a bucket and a wire. But once they were selling diamonds, I suppose they could afford more. But when the claims got consolidated quite a bit, they brought in an American mining engineer whose name was Williams. He was a geologist and a mining man, and he studied this area. And what he decided was that this thing was the remains of an extinct volcano. Now, not a volcano like a Hawaiian volcano. It was an oozing kind of a volcano. In fact, there are no active volcanoes in the world today of the type that these were. Something from down underneath did not come up particularly violently, but it oozed up. And I have read some reports that claim that at one time this had oozed up to the height of Mount Everest. Very tall mountains. Now, as they worked through the yellow ground, they came into a harder material that was blue, which they call blue ground. Farmers down there were real smart, and it was hard, but it still contained diamonds. Now, the reason this ground was yellow is it just weathered, geological action. Rains falling into it, freezing weather, just breaking it up, and oxidation by the oxygen in the atmosphere changed it from blue to yellow. Now, in the beginning, and in fact until quite recently, they would dig the blue ground, which now took dynamite and stuff to really get it out, and break it up and harrow it out on the flat so that the natural action of air would weather it, and over a period of a couple of years in a thin layer, it would be yellow ground again, and then much more easily to work and look through for diamond. As they got deeper, it became difficult to mine, and so Williams, who knew mining, dug shafts in the side. A geologist calls it surrounding rock, it's around all. As these went deeper, they could see that it was a kind of a tube, and they called them pipes. They're called the pipe mines. And Williams concluded that somewhere deep in the earth, there were heat and pressure, sufficient to cause carbon or carbonates or something down there that did contain diamond, or did contain the element carbon to form diamond. Now, they put down in the country rock, which surrounded the pipe, shafts, and then they went in with tunnels, and then they would stope. Now, in mining technology, when you keep caving in the ceiling, that's called stoping. See, instead of getting at it from the top, you go in from the side, and then you dig upward until everything starts to cave in. And you just keep caving things in, you see, and the whole thing keeps sinking to a lower level, but you're hauling it out from the side tunnels. You get it down, and you put in another side tunnel, and you keep doing that. Until some of those mines now are a mile deep. They're a mile deep. As time went on, all the claims were consolidated into two claims. Very interesting situation. One of the men who owned about half of the claims called himself Barney Barnato, and he was the son of a Jewish rabbi. And the other guy was Cecil Rhodes, who was the son of a minister of the Church of England. They call him Vickers. And this fellow Rhodes bought Barney out for a check in the amount of $55 million, which was thought to have been the largest private check written at that time in the history of mankind. And I think I told you once before that that's where Clayton gets his money from for that scholarship he's going to have over there, the Rhodes Scholarship. That's how it all started in the diamond fields of South Africa. You might be interested in some of the techniques they use for getting the diamond out of the blue ground. The diamond is present in very low concentration. I mean, that's where it appears in the highest concentration, but that concentration is still very low. And it's almost the same as it used to be in those Indian river gravels, about one part in 30 to 60 million, something like that. So you really got to look for it. Well, what they do is take advantage of several of the properties of diamond. Nowadays, they break up the blue ground with stiff rubber rollers. Steel rollers first, and then when they get it finer and finer, because if they had a steel roller, they could crush the diamond. I think I told you the diamond is quite brittle, didn't I? Well, if you pass it through steel rollers to break it up, and there happened to be a large fist-sized diamond in there, you'd wreck it. So they have techniques of crushing that are gentle yet quite effective. So if you happen to roll over a big diamond, you probably won't break it. So they get it down to pretty fine. And then, after it's fine, they use sorting techniques by density. Now most of the stuff in there will have a density somewhere around 2.4. The diamonds, as I mentioned before, will have a density of 3.5. But those mines are full of all kinds of stuff besides diamonds. We don't know to this day, the geologists really don't know how those pipes were formed. The stuff in the pipe is a churned up mixture of hundreds of different minerals. A really strange stuff. And by the way, Kimberly, your name probably comes from that. They call that mineral kimberlite. Did you know that? Yeah, kimberlite. The blue ground, the geologists call a blue ground kimberlite. So see, you're just a diamond there in the kimberlite. Well,
Dr. Hall?
Yeah?
Doesn't it get hot down there if you're a mile deep?
Oh, yeah, but it's even hotter in the gold mines of South Africa, which are 2 miles deep. You can't touch the rock, and they have to air condition it. And a great expense of the mining is cooling the thing off clear down there. They don't try to cool the rocks, they just try to keep the air cool. See, South Africa is the world's greatest gold producer. They have a sedimentary deposit there. It's called the Witwatersrand sediments. And it's been under great heat and pressure in the past, and it's turned into a rather tough sandstone. But there are huge quantities of this. And unfortunately, the drift slopes like this. That is, the sediments are, if they were horizontal, it'd be great. But they slope, and so they have to keep going to greater and greater depths to get it. And they're down to 2 miles. And probably won't be able to go much different because the expense of cooling it becomes too great. The earth increases in temperature as you go down through its crust. It starts at 1 degree per 100 feet. So if we go down 2 miles, we are 4,000 feet deep. And if we divide that by 100...
2 miles is more like 10,000.
Yeah, excuse me. 5,280 feet per mile. 10,000. So the temperature goes up 100 degrees, and I think that's what they say. You can boil water. You can boil water on the rock down there. So they have to wear insulated boots on their feet to keep their feet from burning up on what they're standing on, and then they refrigerate, keep cold air going through there for the miners to work. It's quite a problem. The deepest contact that man has had with the interior of the earth is in those South African gold mines, where he has personally been. Now, in oil wells, they go down 5 miles. The deepest oil wells are 5 miles deep. And so you can make temperature measurements, of course, and you still get about the same. This is an average figure, about 1 degree for every 100 feet of depth. Well, you know, if we wanted to heat our houses, dig a 2 mile deep hole and just circulate water down there and up again, see? Get it for free. A lot of trouble with that. That 2 mile deep hole would cost you about $1 million. Always some darn old practical problem that keeps you from taking advantage of things. That's what engineers are for. They're supposed to solve those problems. Let's see, back to our story. This fellow Rhodes was knighted by Queen Victoria, I guess. He became Sir Cecil Rhodes, and he formed a cartel. He went in all kinds of mining in South Africa. He was in gold mining, copper mining, everything that's down there he was in. And I suppose at one time, probably the wealthiest man on earth. But in the diamond area, he formed a cartel, which is known as De Beers Consolidated Mines Limited. They had a really good find on a Dutchman's farm whose name was De Beers. And somehow they started calling it De Beers, so I just picked the name out of the air. Now, they have been able to operate through the years in a very freelance fashion, such as you could not possibly do in the United States. Most European countries in the field of business are not as restricted as we are in the United States. You know, the business is almost smothered with rules and regulations in the United States. And whenever you hit a period like today, you'll see business failures all over the place because they don't have any freedom in which to move. Now, maybe there ought to be some restrictions on business, but you can overdo it, and I'm afraid that's what we've done in our own country. The way the government makes you keep your books, well, our own little company out here struggling to survive. We have not had any cash income in 8 years of existence. But the way the government makes you keep your books, we had last year a $300,000 profit, on which we have to pay taxes even though there's not a cent of money around. That's one of the problems of overregulation of business by government, and they make the rules as to how you keep your books always in the government's favor, so the government constantly gets taxes. I think everybody ought to be forced to go into business so that when they hear the politicians cussing business, they'd say, hey, wait a minute. But you know, it's great to always contend business as the big bad ogre and they're hurting you people out there. Well, sure, business takes advantage of people, but so does government, probably more than business. I'd rather have a businessman run and take my chances with them than a politician, anyway.
Where did that money go?
No, that's because of inventory in our case. We've made a lot of dime, but we haven't sold. We have to pay taxes on it, even though we haven't sold. This is the same thing that's in the automobile account. You have a huge inventory of unsold automobiles, but the way the government forces you to keep your books, you can't keep your books the way you want to keep them. So they have millions and millions of dollars of automobiles out there and have to pay taxes, even though they can't sell it on them. Or the same. Oh, now that's bad for several reasons. It's bad for the consumer because every company in the United States these days tries to work on zero income. That's why you can't find anything on the shelf when you go downstairs and buy something. Inventory is taxed by most states and also by the federal government, corporation tax. And so why should you have something stored on your shelf, unsold, if the government's going to tax you on it? See? And that's bad for business and it's bad for the consumer because you can't get, nobody's going to store it. If I want to buy a tool nowadays, you have to wait for it to be made. Nobody's going to have it on the shelf. And there are other shenanigans that people do. See, California has about 10% inventory tax, which is terrible. So what people do, if they're in something like the diamond business, this only invades the state, it doesn't invade the national. But take their entire supply of diamond and run it over to Nevada for a couple of days. Because the inventory tax in California comes at the year's end. So we got to start in Nevada, where there isn't an inventory tax. And then a few days to think about it in California.
How often can the same inventory be taxed?
whatever it is. The tax in there next year, we still got them, haven't got them. That breaks down, that reduces. But that's just one of the stupid rules that they force off business. The problem has been, well, I can give you many examples, but let me give you, see, it all started, it didn't start then, but let's consider just the income tax on corporations and individuals. When it was started, you paid your tax at the end of the year. You had one full year to, you know, do things, and at the end of the year, we'll take a reckoning and pay your tax. Well, advisors, Franklin D. Roosevelt got the idea, we can sure get a whale of a lot of money if we start making it pay as you go. See, we'll catch up a whole year's taxes ahead, so to speak. And with that money, we'll go into these social programs that we're so desirous of. So now, of course, if you make money more, if you as an individual make more than $200 in a year, over what BYU is extracting from your paycheck, then you must file a quarterly estimate of what you're going to make during that year. If you miss on your estimate, you're penalized in addition to the penalty. If you miss by more than 20% on your estimate, you pay a fine, and you also pay interest of 6%, which I think is going to be raised up to 8 or 9%. So, a businessman, you don't know what's going to happen during the year. How can you predict what your income's going to be for the year? Now, you have a chance to amend that every quarter as you go on, but it's such a headache and such a nuisance, it's just terrible. But the whole game has been to get taxes ahead of time, see? Make the businessman estimate what he's going to make during the year, make him pay tax on it right now. And make me as an individual, if I have income other than wages, estimate what I'm going to earn and pay on it now. Not at the end of the year, but now. And it's always the approach of get the money now ahead of time. Well, see what this does for you when you get in the kind of shape we're in now. There's no reserve. There's nowhere you can turn to get money now. Everybody's had to pay in advance. The government's spending in advance. And it's tough. When you go into a recession kind of thing, things pile up on you in a hurry because there's no reserve. Businessmen don't have any reserve. Not the way the government makes them keep the books. I used to think that if you went in business and you bought a lathe because you needed a new business, write it off. It's a business expense. But it isn't, see? They make you consider it as a depreciable asset. So if I happen to buy a $100,000 lathe and it strapped every cent I could raise to buy that and I had to have it for my business, I think I'd be able to charge it off if I want to. But you can't. The government looks at it and says, well, lifetime of that lathe is 50 years. So we divide 50 into 100,000. What's that go? $2,000? Will allow you to take off $2,000 this year, and $2,000 next year, for on and on. Well, now, it costs a lot of money to buy equipment to get in business, and you have heard of the expedited depreciation allowances and decline balance methods and other things. Occasionally, when the Republicans are in, they get the thing switched so that you have what is called a better depreciation allowance, so you don't have to take so long. You shorten the period up and they let them take it faster. And then the other thing they do is give you an investment credit tax. They give you a benefit for investing in new equipment because it will produce something, see. Well, when the Democrats get in, they're always out of business. I hope not too many of you are Democrats. I'm just telling you the truth, Bill. See, they will take it away and they will not allow it. And right now, you see, there's a big argument going on right now. Businessmen are trying to get the depreciation period shortened up and get a larger investment credit allowance. So the Democrats won't do it, the Republicans won't. It's always that way. Anyway, why I got onto this, what a cartel, when you call something a cartel, while it does mean some bad things, the main thing
it means is that they just run their business the way they darn please. They don't have to pay attention to the United States or anybody else. European nations allow cartels, but De Beers cannot even operate in the United States. They cannot do it. In fact, the U.S. is after it. If De Beers shows up in the United States, if a De Beers high official were to show up in the United States, he'd be hauled into court immediately for some past things that they managed to get away with before they completely abandoned the United States. In fact, they hardly dare even come into Canada. They're afraid they might get picked up there and hauled over into the United States. They're pretty freewheeling, and I'm sure they've done some bad things, but in the main, they've probably done some good things. You hear all kinds of, well, I used to believe it when I was younger, that De Beers were, they'd murdered people and done all kinds of things to maintain the price of diamonds, but now that I'm more mature and had a chance to look at the situation, I don't think it's been any worse than a lot of things, and in the main, it's probably been good. Well, there are a lot of subsidiary companies to this. One of the big ones is Anglo-American. At one point in U.S. history, Christensen Diamond Products in Salt Lake City. Did I tell you about Frank Christensen once? I think I did, didn't I? Those guys were 50% owned by De Beers, but they aren't anymore because De Beers has had to pull out. Also, Engelhard Industries, which is a big outfit in the United States in precious metals, gold, platinum, palladium, osmium, iridium, platinum, so on, was once owned by Anglo-American, which is part of De Beers, but that's also gone by the board now. Well, let's get back to the diamond story. What these guys tried to do through the years was the same thing that Roosevelt tried to do with gold. They tried to keep diamond at a fixed price. In other words, you could always count on diamond as having a set price, never vary. And they succeeded in doing that up until recent times, about the past decade. They just kept diamond at a fixed price, just like gold was kept at $35 by Roosevelt. And probably was a good thing. But things have broken loose all over the world now, and they just can't maintain that price anymore. The whole idea was that diamond always had a constant value. You could rely on it. And they had slogans. You've seen them in the magazines. A diamond is forever. Jewish people in the Nazi regime and whatnot, they'd have diamond. Jewish people have usually had diamond somewhere. It's easy to store, so you can have $1,000 worth of it and nobody knows you got it around. You can swallow it if you have to get across an unfriendly border during a war and things like that. And it's kind of been traditional with Jewish people to always have diamond on hand for an emergency. But we all should have bought them 10 years ago. Diamonds have gone up three times in the past, by a factor of three in the past 10 years. Too bad the Beers hasn't continued the policy, but I guess we have, on a worldwide basis, the prospects of greater inflation than it's ever been in all history. And so even they got scared, I guess, and decided they'd have to let, maybe they were forced to it. The expenses of working in the deeper mines with higher priced wages than they used to pay and whatnot may have forced them into letting the price go. Well, let's see. Up until about 1927, the primary use of diamond was in gemstones. But in 1927, the Germans invented tungsten carbide, and I may have told you this piece of the story, which is cemented together with cobalt powder, somewhere in the range from about 3% on up to 17%, as usual, for cementing fine particles of that together. And the only effective material for grinding tungsten carbide to shape is diamond. And since that time, the use of diamond has been increasing exponentially in industry, so that today, $300 million worth of industrial diamond is used each year. $100 million of that, or one-third of it, being man-made diamond grit. Now, let's go to manufacturing diamond. Let me give you just a brief history of that. Somebody write down another thing.
A few years back, I received an award from the American Institute of Chemists in Pittsburgh, and they called the award the Pioneer Chemist Award. And they gave me a plaque or something. And I gave a speech on that day. And I've run out of copies, but it's being reprinted right now. And it is a sort of a condensed version of my history of synthesizing diamonds. By the time I get back from this trip, they should have been reprinted, and I'll give you a copy. The largest chemical society in the world is the American Chemical Society. This one that gave me this award is known as the American Institute of Chemists. At that time, they were a more elite group. They had about 4,000 chemists belonging to that outfit. They've been trying to increase their membership, and I think they're about 8,000. But the American Chemical Society has at least 150,000 members. I belong to both societies. And a year after the Institute of Chemists gave me the award, then the larger organization decided to give me an award for making diamonds, and they called that one the, let's see, the American Chemical Society Award for Creative Invention. I like their award the best because I got a gold medal with it. And it's really pretty, it's really elegant, about that big around and worth about $1,000. And they also gave me a, so I don't have to carry that one around, they gave me a bronze replica of it. But even better than that, they gave me a plaque with various inscribings on it, you know, and something like the Tracy Hall, the first man to make diamond, the underlined first. And the reason I like that is because there have been at least 40 men who have claimed to make diamonds in the past 150 years. But the thing that is different about their claims and my claim is that in lots of instances they couldn't do it again, and in all instances other scientists could not duplicate it. But in my case, I could do it again after I did it the first time, and other scientists could duplicate it. Now let's go back a little bit on the history of diamonds. Men have been trying to do it since alchemists. The alchemist's interest was in finding some kind of a pill or drink or something that you could take and have everlasting life. That was a big thing with them. The other thing was to take some kind of a pill or water or some kind of a drink that would cure disease. And the other thing the alchemists, boy, they really wanted to do neat things. They wanted to take non-precious stones and turn them into precious stones, and take non-precious metals like lead and turn them into gold. Very ambitious bunch, those alchemists.
Did they ever do anything?
No, they never. But they formed the beginnings of chemistry. Chemistry arose from the ashes of alchemy. That came later. We call it chemistry by the time von Bayer in Germany discovered aspirin.
They can turn lead into gold now, but it costs more than the gold is worth.
That's right. That's right. I'm not going to finish this talk today. We're going to have to do it some more next time. Well, things started to get fairly scientific after about 1830. Alchemy. Well, there were things you could call chemistry before that, but things were really getting squared away at the time of the prophet Joseph Smith. And there were a lot of things that had to go on before a person could look scientifically at the problem of trying to make diamond. First of all, you had to know what diamond was. I mean, what atoms go into it? Well, who do you think discovered that? A Frenchman by the name of Lavoisier. About 1775, right at the time of the American Revolution, he discovered that. 10 years later, without knowing that Lavoisier had done it, it was rediscovered by Smith and Tanet.
These are approximate dates. I may be off about 5 years, maybe even 10. Somewhere around 1790, he was here. This guy was a Scotchman, and that one was a Frenchman.
Now, Lavoisier was the man who discovered oxygen. And having seen, just before Lavoisier, they had the phlogiston theory. The elements were fire, earth, water. What was the fourth one?
Air.
And phlogiston was some kind of stuff that was sort of the spirit of these things. And things were pretty mixed up. But when Lavoisier discovered that there was an element, oxygen, the phlogiston theory was doomed to start dying. It survived for quite a while, but began to die. Well, Lavoisier found out that oxygen was the thing that combusted wood and coal and things like that. And he managed to prepare pure oxygen and went around trying to burn everything in it. He'd take everything he could lay his hands on and heat it up in pure oxygen to see if it would burn. Have you ever seen an experiment where you take some oxygen in a bottle and you light a long stick of wood and it just sort of burns there, and then you suddenly stick it in the oxygen and flash, almost like a flash bulb? Exciting thing to do. Well, like, I guess that sort of thing was first observed by Lavoisier, and he was excited at seeing how things burn. And fortunately, he tried to burn diamond, and he burned it. And then, being the good chemist that he was, he wanted to try and find out what diamond was. So he collected the gases. He knew that carbon dioxide was formed in burning wood and coal and other things. And his test for carbon dioxide was to pass the fumes that came from the burning substance through lime water. Now, lime water, if you take lime, which is just calcium oxide, and mix it, stir it with water, and then let it settle out, you'll have a white sludge here on the bottom of calcium hydroxide. And in the solution, there will be calcium ions and also hydroxide ions. This has limited solubility in the water. So you take a tube from your combustion products and put it in here. And if a white precipitate forms, you have carbon dioxide, because calcium ions will react with hydroxide with carbon dioxide to form calcium carbonate, because there has to be some hydroxide around. So let me rewrite it a little bit. CaO is essentially what you have in the end. And well, it's an intermediate. And then you get calcium carbonate precipitate. So when he burned the diamond, he got that precipitate like he did when he burned graphite. He had already burned graphite. And so he came to the correct conclusion that diamond was carbon, just like graphite. So that goes back quite a long ways when he made that discovery. Now, that was the first important discovery. If you know what the stuff is, then try and make it. So immediately, people became interested in trying to turn graphite into diamond. But chemists don't always start with the pure element. Perhaps you could start with something else. And one of the early experiments, and the first claim I know of, where a man said that he had made diamond, he took 10 tetrachloride. Now, you will recall that in the periodic table, we started with carbon, then it was silica, germanium, and then tin, and then lead. Every one of these compounds will form a tetrachloride. There's carbon tetrachloride, silicon tetrachloride, germanium, tin tetrachloride, and lead tetrachloride. So he took... I mixed up in my story. He didn't use the tin. He used tin, but not tin tetrachloride. He used carbon tetrachloride. And he took an Erlenmeyer flask, which has this kind of a shape, and he put carbon tetrachloride in the bottom. And he hung from a wire and a cork up here a piece of tin, just a little piece of tin. And this is the reaction that he expected to go on.
carbon tetrachloride plus 10 yields 10 tetrachloride plus carbon, hopefully in the form of diamond. If they're not dragging. This is a substitution reaction. We substitute the 10 for the carbon. There are lots of those kind of reactions that go on in chemistry. This man did this several times. He had to let the bottle sit around for years. I think he let some of the bottles sit for 2 years. He claimed he made diamonds that way. But in this modern day, no one else has ever been able to duplicate those claims. Now, this was just chemistry at this point. No one knew any thermodynamics yet. And nobody had any inkling that it might take pressure or temperature. But as time went on, and geologists, you see up here in the 1880s, about 90 years ago, found the pipe mines, or looked at the pipe mines, and saw that high pressure might have been involved in high temperature, then people began to think high pressure, high temperature. 1880s is too late. I have to go back to about 1870 for the geologists making those kind of decisions. Now, there were a whole lot of guys trying schemes such as this one that was tried here. The most scientific person that came along in the early part of this struggle was a guy by the name of Charles Parsons. Was later knighted and became a sir. He began his work on trying to make diamond in 1882, and that's when he published his first paper. He's probably going a few years before that, and on down to about 1922. So that's about 40 years, isn't it? Approximately 40 years. That's just about how long guys seem to last at their research. That's how long Bridgman worked. Now, this Charles Parsons was the inventor of the practical steam turbine. And he formed in Great Britain the company known as the General Electric Company of Great Britain. No connection whatever to the U.S. General Electric Company. And they were building steam turbines to generate electricity and to power.